Hello once again. I think we did not have the rainstorm that Nuno told us we would have. No. He mentioned in the when did he mention it? This morning that there would be a rainstorm. Yeah. Impermanence. Things don't happen like we expect them to happen. I just wanted to come back briefly to some of what we said yesterday and then continue on from there. To remember that Layman Peng's freedom with the ritual of reading the sutra a certain way or not came from his deep practice of adhering to the protocol and reading the sutras as required, respecting the monastery practices. So only once that he had completely integrated the decorum could he be free and realize what the decorum helped him realize, that freedom, let's say, something like that. And all of the ritual that we have here, the decorum that we have here, is intended to help us become free. Because what we are blocked by is our attachments. Our attachments to, oh, I don't want to do it that way, or it's supposed to be done this way. My way is better. That's really heavy to hang on to all the time. I don't want to sing that way. I want my voice to be louder. And, you know, I've told many stories about my own practice and my own resistances and the moments when I was freed from some of those resistances, particularly with Orioki, where I thought that there was this great way to do it that nobody else saw. And then when I mentioned that to my teacher and my fellow students, my teacher said, just do it, Amy. Just do it, like we're saying, do it. Just do it. There was such a liberation in that moment because I suddenly could let go of this idea, this brilliant idea that I had discovered about how to do Orioki that no one else through generations had seen. And
can we hear it?
Oh, yeah, I've told this story many times, but for those who have not heard it, I will repeat it gladly. So at the end of Orioki, after we've washed our bowls, we move our bowls to the... Our bowls are on the far left, right? After we've washed them all and emptied the water and dried them, the bowls are on the far left. And then we are expected to... The instruction is to do a Z like this to wipe off the crumbs on the part of the mat that's not under the bowls. Z. And then the instruction is to move the bowls to the far right and do an N. Same thing, cleaning off the thing. Well, for me, it seemed superfluous to wipe the center twice. Yes. Totally ridiculous, I know. But this is where I was at the time, right? Trying to be brilliant. Brilliant Zen student. And I thought, why do we do this? You know? So it's enough to just, okay, you do the N, then you have the things to the middle and you clean where the bowls were. No problem, you know? So one day my teacher had gathered us all for a day of going through all the rituals, learning all the forms, how to ring the bell, how to chant, how to offer incense, how to bow. It was like the senior students so that we all knew what we were supposed to be doing and we could show other people. So we went through the whole Orioki. And I was just, and we would comment and discuss about things. I was waiting for my moment at the end of the Orioki. And so, you know, I raised my hand in the circle with everyone and said, you know, there's no reason to sweep it twice. So that's where, and my fellow Dharma sisters and brothers just looked at me like, what? Like, kind of like you. They didn't laugh. They were like, what? And then my teacher just looked at me and she said, just do it, Amy. No entering into discussion of why it's done that way, why we shouldn't do it that way, whatever. Just do it. And I was, it's like the bottom fell out of the bucket, as they say. You know, it was like suddenly, wow, oh yeah, I'm totally free. I can just do it. I didn't have to be special and have this brilliant idea and show everybody that I knew, or even, you know, even think about, well, why are we doing it this way? We should do it a different way. Even to myself, you know, it was just do it. Just do it. So liberating. And that's where the decorum can be freeing, if we just give ourselves to it entirely. I don't improvise on Orioki. I still am very precise about it, and I observe, you know, and the thing I've been observing here, which I always forget to mention, is that this is another one of those little things where, you know, so you folded your cloth and you have this point at the top, right? And you have your spatula, which goes between the second and third bowls. And the top of the spatula is supposed to be even with the point of the triangle at the top. Look around. How many people are really doing that? What? It's that precise. You know, and that is something that, oh, okay, we pay attention to that detail. It's not, so it can look like it's really anal and obsessive, but it's not really. It's just that we can give ourselves to this ritual, and that frees us of, first, it keeps our attention, and we have to think about where we're putting the spatula. We don't kind of just stick it in there. There's even this kind of flourish with which we take it out and put it in there. Because we're holding that little case here, supposedly around our heart, and we put it in there, right even with the tip. And this keeps our mind focused, attentive, instead of like thinking about what food is going to come, or even just stuff that doesn't even have anything to do with anything we're thinking about, you know. And it frees us from even having to think about where we will put it. We know that that's where we will put it. And so all of this freeing of our mind allows us then to look more deeply into ourselves and be more attentive to ourselves and the moment and the others. That's what all of the rituals and decorum are about. Really, it's just to keep us focused, present, here and now. Now, as I said in the Samu meeting this morning, so it's the second day. First day, really rough, especially because it's so hot. And if you've never sat before, like some people here, you know, you're brave to jump into a week-long retreat having never sat before. And even for those of us who have sat a lot, it's rough because, whoa, all of the... What has kept us distracted out there in the world all this time, ourselves, basically, all the distractions of daily life are still present, and yet we're sitting here and we can't really engage with them, or we don't know what to do with them, and we are engaging with them, and they're making us suffer and keeping us from being present. We're becoming more and more aware of the suffering around that. It's kind of like... Well, you know, so the ocean, which when the waves come crashing in, for someone like me who didn't grow up around the ocean, it's terrifying. You know, those Portuguese people, you're not really prepared of it because you're just so used to it. As little children, you were there with the waves crashing in. And for me, it's terrifying, and I really don't want to go into those huge waves crashing. But you know that if you do go into those waves, when you get beyond that huge crashing wave, it's really calm out there, you know? People tell me this all the time, but I just don't want to go into the crashing wave, you know? I had a bad experience once when I was a teenager, and so I'm kind of like, ugh, terrified of it. But we know that. And that's, so we're right now, yesterday and today, we're like in the crush of those waves coming in. We're like really in it. And all of those waves of me and that and this and those people and that, you know, all of this stuff. It's just like, and the heat and the sweat and, you know, everything. Fatigue. Fatigue's a big one, you know. It, on one hand, it's really tiring to sit here with all that stuff that is like crashing in on us. On the other hand, the fatigue, the sleep is a super resistance. It's like a protection. It's like, oh, I'm just going to go to sleep. Whether it's on my cushion or whether it's, you know, metaphorically going to sleep and not paying attention to it. Literally falling asleep or metaphorically falling asleep. You know, we have what we call in neuroscience and psychology the fight and flight response. Fight or flight response. So it's stress induced. So when there's stress, we either fight or we flee. So it's fight or flight. And a lot of the science and the research around meditation has shown that meditation puts the nervous system into a neutral mode, which allows it to enter what we call the relaxation response, which allows it to rest, to recuperate, to digest, to recover. That's not the point of the meditation, but that's what happens. According to scientific studies, but I think we can all kind of see how that happens after a few days of sitting, sometimes after 10 minutes of sitting. You know, what's interesting about meditation is that it can be 10 minutes within your busy day and you will have that experience. It can be an hour twice a week and you will have that experience. It can be a short weekend and you'll have that experience. And in a week, it takes maybe a bit longer because we're like delving into it in a different way. We're sitting all day. But the same thing will happen. That's why I said there's rewards to staying with it. But every time you step out of it, if you say, oh, I can't do this, I'm just going to take a break, that's like walking out of the waves. That's like me going back to my towel on the beach instead of going into the waves. Whereas if you persist and keep going into the wave, you will get to that place where the wave is not so fierce and something else is happening. What?
Another wave comes.
Right, well, then another wave comes, yes. Another wave comes. However, you know, like when you're on the beach, the wave is different when it's crashing on the shore, where the rocks are and where the shore is. It's very different when it meets that resistance of the, than it is when it's farther out. It may just be more like zoom, zoom. We're on the beach, it's so if we can go into it and get to that place where it's maybe just instead of we'll have a different experience of our life. So this metaphor of the wave only goes so far, but it's just an image that can help give you an idea what where we are in the process of our week here, you know. And then, of course, everyone has different degrees of that. And maybe some people were feeling really good yesterday and aren't feeling good today. Or maybe some people were fine yesterday and they're fine today. Or maybe there were moments yesterday that were difficult and others that weren't. And the same goes for the actual posture of sitting. So it can be really uncomfortable sometimes. The more we change our position, you know, it gets uncomfortable, so we change. And then 5 minutes later, that's uncomfortable, so we change again. And then 5 minutes later, that's uncomfortable, so we change again. Well, that will be endless. Whereas if, you know, if we can stay in that wave of pain that's bothering us in that position, then we will get to a point of what we say, no pain, where it's completely transformed. Just because we stayed with it, just because we didn't resist the, you know, like my teacher said to me during childbirth, go in the same direction as the pain. So instead of resisting it, you know, trying to contain it or push it away or move so that it goes away, stay with it. Of course, this practice is not about becoming a martyr on your cushion. At some time, we do have to change, but maybe try to stay a little longer than you think. And then one period, sit on the cushion, and then the next period, sit on a chair. Or try sitting like this instead of cross-legged, or try a bench, something. Try different things, but maybe not within the same sitting period. And then you will have an opportunity to find what is right for you. If you keep changing all the time, you won't find it. But if you can stay and just let things settle and be, then you will find that place that's right for you. Your position is right. So that's about, yeah, the second day. We won't go to the third and fourth days yet, but when we get there, we will. Yeah. It was funny because at the train station, when we were waiting for Nuno and Patricia to come and get us, there were some people hanging around at the train station. There was this guy hanging around there, and he had on a t-shirt that said in French, "Je ne fais rien et je le fais bien." So, I'm doing nothing and I'm doing it well. You know, he was just some guy who hangs around the train station in the cafe having beers with his friends. I mean, he was not like, I don't know where he got that t-shirt. But maybe he was, like you say here in Portugal, one of the immigrants, right, who has come back from France for August and had his t-shirt, I don't know. The thing is, and I wrote that down because we may try to see ourselves clearly and we may try to understand and grasp and analyze what we're experiencing or something, but the fact is that we see ourselves most clearly when we do nothing. That guy's t-shirt made me think of that when we do nothing, when we are just here, that's when we have the opportunity to see ourselves most clearly and see the world most clearly. And that's what this meditation is about. That's the ultimate, you know, that's like the, in Japanese they call that shikantaza, which is like really the supreme practice. Very difficult. It means just sitting. Really difficult practice. Because we are so caught up with the distractions of doing, getting, obtaining, accomplishing. It's really hard to just do nothing and do it well. And when we do nothing, we don't even do it well. As soon as we start saying, I'm doing it well, we're caught again. So it's really just sitting here, which is really difficult to do. Which is why we have techniques that help us. So we have all the ritual and decorum. None of us would have sat here all day yesterday in this room without this structure. I certainly wouldn't have, you know, I would have been in the pool or I don't know what, but I wouldn't have been sitting in this room with this heat and all of this, you know. So the structure really is helpful. And part of the structure is the other people. That's where this, spiritual friendship and comradeship comes in. We're supporting each other. The structure is supporting us. We're supporting each other. The time, that's part of the structure. So we have this timekeeper who rings the bell to start and finish, which helps us to stay there on our seat and not move. It's not about physically not moving. It's about not moving from the moment. But that timer helps us to not move. Sometimes we're just desperate. We can't wait for that bell to ring, and we're waiting for the time, the Jikido to look at her watch to Or we hear the clock, the church bell, and we're like, ah, it's 12:15.
What?
We're lucky.
That's right. Okay. Well, we're lucky and we're not lucky, because that's like we're focusing on that then, you know? We have this great koan. How do you stop the sound of the distant temple bell? Yes, that's a big koan. So how do you stop the sound of that bell? And it's possible, but not like we think. It's like it's possible to do nothing, but not like we think. It's possible to see the true self, as we say, but not like we think. Because what we think is what's getting in the way. In Coimbra, it was in April when we were there, when we went to the 25th anniversary march, and the whole weekend was kind of devoted to that. And I framed the teaching kind of in this mode of, which I deeply believe, and that's my way, of your true self is a rebel. Your true self is a revolutionary. And it refuses, when it wakes up, it refuses to adhere to the status quo, which is oppressing it, which is keeping it subservient, you know, keeping it caught up in the worldly world and consuming and competing and violence and jealousy and all of the great passions that we get caught up in. There's nothing wrong with passion. The problem is the attachment to it. And this rebel is the one who is by nature free. And each of us is that rebel, our true nature, that's who we truly are. And yet we're living under this dictatorship. That's how I framed it, you know, when we were in Coimbra. Living under this system that is oppressing us. The system of the what we call the small self, you know, that causes us suffering, that is keeping us asleep, you know, that keeps making us, not only makes us fall asleep, but keeps us asleep. You know, it's dumbing us, it's making us, it's our ignorance, right? And this rebel true self, your true being, is a revolutionary. And it works to, when it wakes up, it instigates a revolution of the mind and the heart and the world, actually. Because if your heart and mind is awakened, that changes how you move in the world, and that changes how you interact with others, and then that changes how they interact with you, and that your step of awakening is radical and revolutionary. So what you're doing here is, I often say, you know, this is like the subversive, this is the ultimately subversive thing you could do, is sit here on a cushion and wake up to your true self and no longer be oppressed. All of these rituals and decorum are there to help us do that. We use that as a support, like a crutch, to help us rise up, to help that rebel voice rise up. And then we can come to this, you know, as I said, we come to that place of not doing. And that's where we truly, it doesn't mean, so not doing doesn't mean not doing. And this is Zen jargon, but it means that we are moving effortlessly in the world, something like that. Even when we're making an effort to do whatever we're doing. But we're not caught by the self's idea, the oppressed self's idea of how to be, how to look. The servers, when they come in here and serve us, they're not, worried about us all looking at them and thinking, oh, he's really beautiful. Or, you know, oh, he's the best server. Or she does it better than him. Or judging. We're basically caught up and we just want the food. and not paying a whole lot of attention to the servers. But that's not true. I mean, that's an exaggeration. We are. And part of the ritual is that. Is the selfless serving and receiving. So we're receiving selflessly, and they are serving selflessly, which allows us to completely acknowledge the other when we're not caught up with acknowledging only ourself and our idea and our desire for that food, or, oh, I don't like that food, or he's giving more food to the other person, or why did he give such small spoonfuls to me? You know? Or there's not going to be enough left for me. I don't actually have to worry about that because I have this, you know, place where I'm served first. So I don't have to worry about when it gets to the end of the line, is there enough? But I know what that is. You know, I may be worried about, will there be enough for a second serving? So should I take more now? You know, that kind of stuff. We have all this calculation that goes on. You know? All this stuff that goes on. Which is all about this self that is, you know, oppressing the true self. However, as Ram Dass famously said, when someone asked him if he was free of all that, he was free of all that neurosis and all that stuff, he said, no, that's not at all what it is, you know. It's that it's just become these tiny little things that are down there, you know, appearing, but he's not caught by them. So, you know, I might see this, oh, I want more food, or why is he giving more food to somebody else, or whatever. But I'm not caught up in it. I'm like, oh, okay. Fine. You know, that's that. And the rebel is present to say, it's okay. You know, it's okay. You don't have to have that top dog place and oppress the rest of us. It's okay. You know, you have your place, but this is not it. So all of this becoming free and not being stuck by the decorum and the rituals is about selflessness. You know, so selflessness. I'm not attached to my idea of what I should wear. My Zumi Roshi is selfless. He puts on a tie and a coat and sits at the table and talks about art history with Gena Roshi's mother. Doesn't have to give a Dharma talk, doesn't have to be seen as anything special, isn't clinging to his identity of Zen master, doesn't wear a rakusu in the restaurant, you know, just selfless, gives himself to it. And that's because of all his years of practice that he's able to do that. And all of us are able to do that by even coming here and agreeing to sit like this. Sit in a place that's assigned to you, sit all day long, eat a certain way, be in a meeting at a certain time. That's all very selfless. You know, there might be a selfish aspect to it. We like it, we want to get something. We want to wake up, we want that rebel to be present, whatever it is, that's okay. But the act of it is selfless. And will lead to, you know, what the Dalai Lama calls inner peace. But what he means by inner peace is not some, like, let's go to the spa and have a treatment and come out and feel peaceful. That's not what he's talking about. Inner peace is really nonviolence. So it's no longer struggling. No longer, it's not that fight and flight. It's no longer resisting, and therefore, it's peaceful. You know, it's the place where the wave has already, you know, is not crashing. Not totally peaceful, but that's just an image, let's say. Or in the eye of a hurricane, we know it's absolute stillness in the eye of the hurricane. Everything around it is spinning and whirling and destruction, whatever. But in the middle, in the eye of that hurricane, it's absolute stillness. So can we find that place of absolute stillness in ourselves? And it may be just a fleeting moment of tasting it. But once you've tasted that, and you're paying attention, because probably we all experience it regularly, and we're not paying any attention. We're distracted by all the other stuff. But when you taste that, when you experience that, it's like, oh yes, I know this. I think children experience this a lot, but they don't even think of it as, it's just another thing, you know, that's happening. Or they may be just like so deeply into it that they're not thinking about anything else other than that. And then, you know, somebody comes along and says, do this, do that, you're not doing it right, or, you know, you're bad or something. Or you're great, and then they get caught up in that. And if they would try to talk to an adult about this stillness, they wouldn't even know how to talk about it. But if they did, the adult would be kind of like, yeah, yeah, right, you know, finish your homework or something. So it's like we're returning to something that is who we truly are. And the fact that you sit here and do this is that somewhere you know that. Somewhere you recognize something in this. You may not be your daily experience. You may never have that experience as far as you know. I would tend to think that you have had it, but the fact that you're here, it's like, oh, I recognize something in this. There's something here that speaks to me. But it's so buried under the oppressive little person who's telling you what to do and not what to do and how to be and not how to be and being caught up in the emotions that we've forgotten it. Something like that. So it's about returning to that, who we truly are. I'm just glancing at my notes because after yesterday I wrote down some notes and I don't want to overlook something. So when we're free from all of that, when we're not caught up in all of that, like I said, we can see ourselves most clearly when we're doing nothing. So when that happens, when we no longer have any distraction to look at, well, the only thing to look at is here, is you, who you truly are. Once you've exhausted all of the stuff, that's what koan practice is about. It's like exhausting all of the ideas and the opinions and the analysis and the rationalizations and the stuff you've read. And once you've exhausted all of that, and it's a lot of work, you know, it's going into the wave again. Once you've managed to weather all of that and exhausted it all, then there's nothing else to see. There's just this. Just however you want to identify that, just this. You know, my Dharma name is Tu es cela, so you are that. You are this. So when I say just this, well, it's you. And as Ikkyu, a Japanese Zen poet and teacher said, there's only one koan, or the only, I think I wrote this down too. No, I didn't write it down. Something like, only one koan matters, or something. You. So, really, that's it. But to get to that, we have to kind of wade through all this stuff, you know, and walk up. It's kind of like doing the kinin, which the path is already made for us, so we don't have to do it. But we have to take every step. So this path has been laid out, however we identify the path. You know, we can say Shakyamuni Buddha 2,500 years ago, and then all of the ancestors throughout time. Or we can even, you know, bring it even more local. So when we arrived, people had already put in place the Zendo. So the path is already made for us. The teachings are there. The teacher is there telling you all this stuff. But you have to walk it. You have to take every step and discover that path yourself. It's there. It's right in front of you. You are it, But you have to find it. You have to come to it. By doing nothing. You know, this is the Zen paradox. You know. And actually, all of the stuff. Well, there's another koan where it's a poem, actually, where some probably Chinese monk or someone had some, you know, I think it's like the sound of something struck, and then suddenly this realization that all of the practice and all of the effort was completely unnecessary. Not unnecessary because it brought him to that, but it was that's not what it's about. All of the effort, but it's necessary. So it's unnecessary in the way we think it is, but it's necessary to get to that moment of stillness of doing nothing, like something like that. And this can be, you know, terrible, tragic to think about. Think, well, then why am I doing all this? Master Dogen's thing that started him on, first his mother died when he was like 8 years old, and this was a tragic thing for him, and he saw his mother's dead body there and had this, you know, question about life and death. And his family, he was from like a noble family, and they sent him into a monastery, which was typical at the time for, could be, you know, rich families. They would send their young people to monastery. So he went in and became a monk. And after a few years there, his question became, well, they're telling me, they keep, all the teachings say we're already enlightened. You're already that. You are that. So then he thought, well, why do we have to do all this? If we're already enlightened, why do we have to go through all this? All the effort and the decorum and the rituals and the struggle and all of that. A good question, right? A good question. And that was what fueled his practice. If I'm already enlightened, if I'm already this true self, if I'm already awakened, like we say, or if I'm already Buddha, why do I have to do all this? Good question. Which we can each look into. And it brought Dogen to great things. He went to China to find a Zen teacher and brought the teachings back to Japan and then gave us our Zen tradition. So important things came from that question. And important things come from every question in our lives. We don't have to go on and become, you know, a legendary Zen master who changed the world in that way. The change is here. You know, it's waking up this rebel and acting that revolution of your heart and mind. That's what's important. And we have this, another koan that I had to look up to write down, because for me it was a I had another, you know, difficult day when I was a young student after hearing this koan. I heard it like this. You know, the teacher was giving the Dharma talk about it. So it's from the Blue Cliff Record, and it's case 92. Blue Cliff Record is one of the collections of koans that we use in our practice. One day, the world-honored one ascended the rostrum. So the rostrum is like something high up. And in those days, you know, probably in the Buddha's day, there were so many people, you know, it was a huge crowd. So he had to go up onto something higher so he could see them all or something. I don't know, but they could see him. So the world-honored one, being the Buddha, ascended the rostrum. Manjushri, one of the great bodhisattvas, struck the gavel and said, "Behold the Dharma King's Dharma. The Dharma King's Dharma is like this." The world-honored one descended the rostrum. So, he goes up to give the Dharma talk. Like we have, you know, the chant at the beginning, he strikes the gravel to, like, say, okay. Apparently, and that's what it was, they would say, you know, strike the gavel, like we say, we are going to hear the Dharma, it's infinitely subtle, incomparably profound, all of this. He strikes the gavel and he says, behold the Dharma King's Dharma. Get ready, you're going to hear it, you know. And then at the end, they would do that again, and they would say, the Dharma King's Dharma is like this. What you just saw and heard was that's the Dharma King's Dharma. Well, in this case, the Buddha doesn't do anything. He just comes up, the guy says the first part and the second part, and the Buddha goes down. That's the Dharma talk, right? So, what? Did someone say something? No? Okay. So, why was that devastating for me? Because I had this realization that, oh no, it's just this, it's just me, it's my life as it is the Dharma. I wanted it to be something else. Someone else. I was going to become someone else. Or it was going to be outside of me and I would obtain it or something. But it was just this. It was being embodied. I mean, now I see this koan completely differently. But at the time, I had was not very advanced in my koan practice. It was the week when I was taking Jukai, actually. So this was, well, it was 30 years ago. So I was really into this Jukai and making my Rakusu, and I, you know, I was like a really intense Zen student. Probably not a lot of fun to be around, but and so when I heard this, it was my teacher's teacher who did this, and I don't remember anything he said about the koan, I just remember the koan. I just cried the whole afternoon. Because it was devastating to find out that I was not going to be anybody else. And that the teaching was this, was me, you know. Of course, that's kind of presumptuous to say when it was talking about the teaching being the Buddha embodying it there, that he didn't need to say anything, he was the teaching. But the implication of it is that you too are the teaching. And that every moment is a teaching, as I said, you know. When we were talking about separating the Dharma and Zen practice from daily life, well, it's all teaching. It's all the Dharma. And now I can appreciate it in that way. At the time, I couldn't. It took me a couple days, I think, to appreciate it in a different way. Or maybe years, but... it is just this, really. And yet we have all this stuff we say about it, and we all these traditions, and these great teachers, and these techniques, and, you know, like the Tibetans have all these amazing tankas and archetypes, and, you know, infinite lives of before you awaken, and reincarnation, and all this stuff. But it's all talking about the same thing. Really, it's about just being here now. And waking up to it here and now. And then moving in the world as that rebel. And the rebel actually moves in the world as completely ordinary. Nothing special. Because before the rebel has managed to emerge and make that revolution of the mind and the heart, there's a lot of struggle to be extraordinary. To have a position, to be somebody, to have a special place, to have special privileges, even if it's, you know, like me with my little Oreoki thing, you know, wanting to be special and have everybody think I'm brilliant or whatever it was. Even though, you know, I wasn't even thinking of it in those terms, but that's what was happening, you know. It was just so habitual to function that way. In a million different ways.
Isn't it because somehow we already know we are special?
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it, you know?
Well, when it comes to our journey.
You know, that's a very interesting way to look at it, because maybe it is something like that. And that we know that we're special, but we're mistaken about how that special manifests and what it means to be special. You know, that's a good point. We think being special is being extraordinary, and we already are extraordinary, you know? It means being separate, because as soon as we say, usually when we talk about special, it's separate, so, and it's a value judgment of better or worse. So the special one, José Mourinho, right, is better than the others. I don't mean him particularly, because I know everybody in Portugal really likes him, but, or maybe not, maybe that's not true. Mourinho. Yeah.
The special one.
Absolutely. That's true. That's true. After a retreat once, when we were coming back from somewhere in the north, I think, north of Porto. I don't know who the guy is, because I never saw him again, but he was giving me a ride back to Porto, to the airport, and there were some other people in the car, and we drove past the stadium there in Porto. Dragão. And he was like a super... No, it was not a man, actually. It was a woman who was driving, yeah. And she was like a super FC Porto fan. Mm-hmm. And maybe it was like around the time when Porto had won the European Cup or something. I don't know. And she... So we started talking about the special one. And she said, oh, he really is special. He apparently can go into the changing room, you know, in the dressing room, where the locker room, as we say, where the team is at halftime, and he can say, you will score in the 61st minute to some player. And then they go out there, and that's what happens.
No.
She said this. I don't know if that's true. I thought it was a little outrageous, but... it was to that extent she thought he was the special one, you know. Some of you maybe don't even know what we're talking about. There's this football coach, Portuguese, famous Portuguese football coach, José Mourinho, who, when he came to take over a... I think it was to go in England to Chelsea, actually. Was it? Yeah. And in his first news conference, he was like coming because the team was doing poorly and they were bringing him in to save the team and everything. And he sat down and he said, yes, I am the special one.
And that... The name comes from there.
From that story.
Yeah.
When he was in Porto, it wasn't yet the special one. Yeah.
What?
It's not a joke.
No, it's not a joke. I mean, this is true. It's really true. He said that. So it's followed him throughout his career. And just to say that, so when we use it in that sense, it's, you know, a value judgment. José Mourinho is special. Like, all of us are special. And he is an extraordinarily talented football coach. No, and he did amazing things. But when we start, you know, making it into something like, I'm special, and the others are not special, then we're missing what the original face, or the true self, or the our true being, which is special. But each being is special in that sense. So, how are we doing for time?
Ten past.
Okay. So yeah, we have time for questions or comments or.
I've got a question about being special, and then at the beginning of the talk, talk about, I can't remember the word you used, but when you're serving and you disappear.
selfless.
Yeah. How do you, that, well, it's a pitfall of then going to self annihilation, or,
right.
or the ego,
right.
I'm special, so therefore I'm going to become enlightened, or something like this. So it's just making me think about those pitfalls. I don't know if you can talk.
Yeah. When we talk about selflessness, I really like what Shogyam Trungpa said about the bodhisattva. So the bodhisattva is the Buddhist archetype of the one who has awakened and seen the oneness and the non-separation of self and other, and devotes their life, their existence, to helping others to awaken as well, right? So Shogyam Trungpa said, the thing about the bodhisattva is that it's not that she no longer cares about herself. So it's not about self-annihilation. It's she no longer cares only about herself. When we have that awakening moment of seeing the oneness and the non-separation of self and other, we see that I am the other, so the self of me and the self of the other are one. So of course I can't care just about myself. That's what the selflessness is in that sense. And then the ego. The ego is like this oppressive dictator that we're stuck with, you know. The ego has its place. You know, there's a lot of definitions of ego. In Freudian psychoanalysis, it's something else, you know. So that's why we kind of talk about the small self, or let's just stay with the ego, though. It's the self that we're completely identified with, and which is identified with ideas, positions, history, pains, delights, all that stuff. And as long as it imposes that regime on our being, you know, it reduces who we are to that. Instead of, because its existence depends on that. If we expand our experience of who we are to include the trees and the flowers and the birds and the person in front of me, well, the ego is deeply threatened. Its existence is in danger. It's an endangered species. So it has to maintain its existence with all of this stuff, you know, all of this apparatus we put of self, me, fame, glory, possessions, competition. It needs that for its survival. When the rebel voice can rise up, you know, it can compassionately hold that ego, you know, because usually around that ego is a lot of pain, trauma, difficulty, struggle, and can acknowledge that part of ourselves that wants to be seen, that wants to be understood, that wants to be held, that wants to be recognized, that wants to be special. So when Marlene, you know, suggests that the ego is acting from this place of wanting to be special, but it thinks that it's the only special one, you know? It's the only Mourinho, you know? whereas when the rebel voice can rise up and agitate for this revolution of the heart and the mind, the ego can have its place and can be held within, you know, we can have a compassionate heart. The revolution of the heart is awakening the compassionate heart. And when that compassion awakens, it can hold the ego. Or sometimes we say the inner child, or we have all these terms that we use for these parts of ourselves that have been oppressed or have been pained, mistreated, and then what arises from that.
You know, when I'm listening to you, I'm thinking that because you say that we can meet the true self, like sitting on the cushion or doing nothing, because so this is the best moment where you can face ourselves. But I really, when you were talking, I'm really thinking that you know, this little moment, these experiences of unity, I really can experience that when I'm creating, like simple thing, like because lately I'm filming a lot. And you know, when I'm filming, there is one point when I can meet that. I don't know, maybe...
When you can miss what?
I can meet this moment.
Oh, you
moment.
Can meet that, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, because it's like I can experience that when I photography, or I can experience that when I film. But this is... It's not happening all the time, but at one point, this moment, I can see that everything is perfect and everything goes, you know. So I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, and I think any artists recognize that, you know, whether it's music, painting, writing, whatever, and other people too in your creative pursuits, whatever it is you do. It can be cooking, it can be walking in the forest, whatever. And that, so we can sometimes we say that's an accident that happens. The circumstances, you know, the planets have aligned in that moment, and wow, you know. Of course, you have worked to make that happen, but you're not intentionally. You don't know when that's going to arise, right? And so I wouldn't say the best moment to have a moment like that, the best place is on the cushion. You started out by saying the best, I said the best place is that. I didn't say the best place. However, this practice helps us to cultivate those accidents. Cultivate the ground so that accidents will happen. So that those moments will happen. So that we can have a moment like that. You know, plenty of artists don't have any meditation practice and come to that. But their work, their discipline, acts in a similar way as our meditation discipline acts, can act. Although it's not about a spiritual realization. It can be, you know. But not every artist is involved with a spiritual realization. So yeah, I understand, absolutely. I was just talking with Lisa about that, the film that I talked about years ago, Inside Out, that Pixar film. And I don't know if any of you... In French, it's Vice Versa. Vice Versa.
Inside Out.
So in the first... I haven't seen the second one yet, but the first one... there's a moment when, you know, sadness and happiness are lost, and they sadness and joy, yeah, they're lost. And they have to get back to the headquarters so that the little girl will not be... If you haven't seen it, this doesn't make any sense. But in any case, at one point they have to go through, they have to catch the train of thought. There's this train, it's called the train of thought, and they have to get on it. And the shortcut to get back to headquarters is through abstract thinking. And the one of them is saying, we can't go in there. No, I think sadness is saying, you have to be really careful if you go into that cave of abstract thinking. It's really dangerous. You have to be careful. But it's a shortcut, so they go in there. And then the animation is that little by little they're completely disintegrating, and their idea of themselves and who they are, and even their shapes are, it's kind of becomes cubist, you know, and then melting away into just vague lines and things. And the more that they do that, they come nearer and nearer to the cave of imagination and creativity, which is really interesting. So it's like we have to let go of our fixed idea about ourselves and what we're doing and who we are to enter into that space of creativity and imagination, which then allows them to return. I don't remember, I forget the rest, how they get to where they're going. But that's really a profound thing that they're showing little children in this animated program, you know? I don't know how much they get of it, but... What?
They Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
My child, she's not a child anymore. But
at the time,
was,
yeah.
At the time she was. And she did get it. And she is autistic. It's Asperger's. And it was really enlightening for her.
Oh, that's wonderful. Wonderful.
I recommend the second one.
Yeah, I'm going to see it when I go back, actually. I didn't have time to go before. Lisa said she had seen the second one, too. Yeah. What? Well, it's not yet streaming, the second one. It's at Méliès. I'm going to go on Monday. What?
You haven't seen the first one. I have a question. Because you were talking about how success sometimes kind of like makes us, it's like a prison, like it's connected to our ego. But what about, for example, you have work and you are happy with the work, you like to do it, but sometimes you're not really motivated. That success is what motivates you to go past that. So isn't success the thinking of like, I want to be successful, doesn't it help sometimes?
Yeah, and I guess what maybe how we could look at it is how we, what we're talking about with success. You know, does it mean I have this job to do and I finish it and I did it well. I did it like, you know, and I did it in a really good way, or I don't know when what we're talking about with success. Or does it mean, you know, I was voted employee of the week, or, you know, I get a promotion because I was so good? I mean, that also can be positive. But if we're only motivated by success, we probably won't do our job well. It can be, and it is a good motivation to, I want to succeed. I want to do this, you know. So I come to this, I give a Dharma talk, and I can say, well, I want to succeed. I want to, you know, I hope that what I'm saying will help you on your path in some way. And that does motivate me. But I don't have a specific idea of what that will look like. I don't know. In fact, it's often not what I thought. Someone will come to me and say, well, just recently, Claudia saw someone who I haven't seen for years, and he said, tell Amy, I haven't forgotten about panoramic awareness. I have no clue. I'm sure I talked about it at some time. And maybe even in an interview with him, I talked about it. And it was important for him, and he hasn't forgotten it.
Yeah, and I think each one of us is one of the...
Absolutely.
I already said something you said, and you... I don't remember.
But that's great, yeah. Yeah. And that's... so. But if I'm fixed on, you have to hear this, you have to do that, some specific result, which I'm identifying as success, I won't be true to the moment. So maybe that's how you
could... Yeah, but my question was like, in those, not always, but like in those days where you're not really motivated, maybe you didn't sleep well or something, and oh, I have to work, then that success, just that, sometimes it's what gets you through the day. And
yeah,
and you do the job well, basically.
Absolutely.
Not anything fancy, but do it.
And that's we could say that's a positive way of using success, you know? Instead of a compliment, I'm going to be brilliant or something, I don't know, whatever it is. Yeah, good. It's funny because it's the way that we define the words that's why in Zen we have these words that we think mean something, and yet they don't mean what they're saying. So success can be a tricky one like that.
Because it's also a worldly dharma, success, isn't
it? What?
It's a worldly dharma. A world, success in the eight worldly,
exactly,
dharmas.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. And these are relative terms, you know, too. So, but I guess what I hear and what you're saying, it's not like you're motivated to not fail or something. You're motivated because, okay, you really don't want to go do this, but the motivation of doing it successfully is enough. You know?
Because of the commitment.
Yeah, exactly, because I like that and I want to do that.
Exactly. You like the feeling of
sometimes
that.
Sometimes you don't like it. I'm sorry. For instance, sometimes when it's not about work, but in life, sometimes I am in those days that everything this. I don't want to do anything. I feel so bad. I feel. And then I just put my stove, and the stove is so it's nothing. It's just cleaning the stove.
Yeah.
It's, but you accomplished something, and that day you didn't want to do anything. That's a kind of success, I think.
Sure, you know, sure.
Like you, that's the thing. Like it's just sometimes, some days you don't.
But if you go past that and do just a little thing, you accomplished something.
Well, because that brings us back to what Maizumi Roshi said about everything is important. So cleaning the stove is important. And I think that, you know, when we could say that, so when we do this practice and we sit and we get through all of the turmoil and the crashing wave and we have these moments of stillness, then every day is a good day. And we don't have those days so much when, ugh, I don't want to do anything today. Because everything is special, everything is important. So even if it's just a day of, you know, going to work when I don't want to, or whatever it is, it's just what it is, and we can appreciate it for what it is. Every day is a good day. I was thinking of one of the koans we have where the student asks the teacher, how do I get to the place where there's no hot and heat and cold?
Mm-hmm.
Where the place where there is no heat and cold.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he was in a place like here where it's really hot, you know. And the teacher said, when it's hot, kill yourself with the heat. When it's cold, kill yourself with the cold. Which means, when we're talking about killing that little self who doesn't want the heat, the little self who doesn't want the cold, just be with it, you know. So that's why I said our practice is just to sit here with the sweat, the heat, just be with it. Just sit through it, with it, be with it.
But what about, because your body says if you're going to have this much longer, you might like have might become ill or might die, so
that's right.
It's still like that feeling, it's good because it's saving you. And for example, if you have a medical condition, you really can't just sit there.
Absolutely.
So
yep. But that implies, you know, just when it's hot, just be hot. That implies everything, you know. So let's take panoramic awareness. Panoramic awareness of the heat and all that involves for you, you know. So if you have a medical condition, you need to drink, close the windows and the shutters when it's hottest during the afternoon, don't do a lot of exercise, drink a lot of water. Yes, absolutely. Because again, this selflessness is not about not taking care of yourself and taking care of others.
It's working with your body in it. Your body's telling you something. So just trust it.
And it's the awareness.
Right, exactly. Yep. And often we have this idea of, oh, it's hot, I can't do this. But to some degree we can. However, you know, like I said we would take a walk during the week. We won't do it in the afternoon. We'll do it in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
When it's cool, between 7 and 9, it's beautiful out there, you know?
Yeah.
So we adapt our practice accordingly. We won't stick to this fixed idea of we have to take a walk at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. No.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's time to eat. So we will be selfless and go away, go on to something else.
The four bounds?
Yes, let's do the four bounds.